Georgia Dunstan is a professor with the graduate faculty at Howard University with a long and prestigious career in the field of genomics. Professor Dunstan has collaborated across fields with a particular interest in science, ethics, and religion. Over the years, she's become a leading and inspiring voice in the field. Dr. Michael Reed Trice sat down with Professor Dunstan recently, and this is what she had to say.
This is a Religica production. R-E-L-I-G-I-C-A.
At Howard University, one of the major areas of research focus for me is human genetics. In fact, my graduate degree, my PhD, is in human genetics. And it was during the course of my time at Howard that the Human Genome Project came on the scene as a major international initiative.
Was that in the early 80s, or is it when did that start to really ramp up? I can't quite recall.
The thoughts of it reverberated in the hearts of geneticists probably early on, but it was with the development of the DNA technology that the practical reality of being able to sequence the human genome, which was a major objective of the Human Genome Project in the 80s. But the actual start, formal start of the Human Genome Project was 1990. And it was projected to be a 15-year project. So from 1990 was an expected end date of 2005. Okay, 15 years.
Amazing.
Now, the human genome sequence is a DNA sequence, a sequence of nucleotides, letter representations. The four are the adenine, which is A, the thymine, which is T, the guanine, which is G, and the cytosine, which is C. Now, the DNA strand is these four chemicals lined up or in order, and there are 3 billion parts. So you kind of think of a jigsaw puzzle, if you will.
Yeah.
But it's a jigsaw puzzle where all the parts are one of four shapes. Okay. All, and we're talking, yes, billion. We're talking to the ninth pieces in this jigsaw puzzle. And it's a puzzle of 3 billion parts. All of that information is encoded in the human genome as the complete set of instructions for making and operating the human body.
So I have to ask two questions, and forgive me for not being a scientist. On the one hand, with all of that sequencing completed, what makes us different, let's say, from another organism like a mouse? That's the first question. And the second one is, what makes us so different from one another in our humanity?
Oh, Michael, you love to bring these questions in. Absolutely. And it's no coincidence that you're asking that question. What is the relationship of having sequenced this genome to our understanding and our knowledge of ourselves in relationship to ourselves? Mm. But also in relationship to each other. Who am I?
Okay.
The DNA is structured in chromosomes. Humans have a set of 23 chromosomes. Other animals have a set of chromosomes that also code for their information. All humans, by definition, have 23 sets of chromosomes, a total of 46 chromosomes. 22 of those are what we call the somatic or make up the body. And then we have the X and Y, which we call the gender of the sex chromosomes. The X for the female, the Y for the male. Keep in mind, each human being begins the biological stage of life as a single cell, a single cell. A cell, which we call the egg from the mother, has 23 chromosomes, one of which would be the X. The sperm from the male also has 23, one of which would be the Y. At fertilization, when the sperm penetrates the egg, that penetration starts the program of making the human genome unfold. And each of us starts as a single cell with two complete sets or two complete genomes, and with each genome having all the information for making the human body.
They're just that one cell.
For making the whole body, and not just making the parts, but how the parts work together to give you a functional and ideally a healthy person.
These things are happening around us. Massive confusion, animosity, hate speech, violence. Do you, as a scientist and as a person of faith, find it more than ironic, maybe tragic, that we're missing the forest for the trees? We share this whole human genome, all of us. How do you make sense, given our national global context, how do you make sense of all of that as a scientist and as a person of faith?
One of the first lessons that came from the knowledge was that it takes, and these numbers have been verified, they're in the literature, it takes less than 0.1% to make all the proteins, and we can identify parts of the genome that makes proteins, okay?
Mm-hmm, okay.
It takes less than 0.1% of our total genome to account for all of the differences that we see on the surface. All the differences that distinguish us on superficial or surface. All the information that's needed to account for differences in skin color, in hair texture, in anatomical features. The amount of our total inheritance required to account for all the ways we group ourselves, largely on geographic origins, if you will, less than 0.1%.
Let's take a look at disease. So now we have the genomic sequence completed, and we have people out there. In fact, we recently had a spotlight at Religica on Fragile X syndrome or other families with special needs where it's genetically situated.
Yes.
Are we at a place where we would be able to go into that sequence and be able to see where that fragile gene is and provide a corrective? I mean, how far off are we on significant cures to some of the things that have ailed humanity at a genetic level?
It's already here. It's already here. This relationship, your question is right on. So if we get the sequence of the human genome, we can go in and find the genes that are associated with and ultimately that cause a particular disease. Literally go in and identify the sequence of the DNA that has been shown to be out of order and compared with what we would call the normal persons that do not have whatever phenotype. In this case, the Fragile X is actually a genetic disorder. But once you can identify what the problem is, yes, we have the technology now to go in and literally replace it, just as we can go in and diagnose the problem in a car, for example, and remove that part that's the defect and just replace it with that which has been aligned with the functioning aspect. That technology is already here and a major area of discussion among scientists and the community. The Genome Project promised to get the knowledge that would be applicable to treating, preventing, and hopefully, certainly to diagnosing common diseases. That's why in the early days of the genome product, it was not uncommon at all to see on the headlines a gene for hypertension, a gene for cancer, a gene for asthma, a gene for these very complex diseases that we now know the science shows us there are very complex pathways with multiple genes interacting in different ways at different points that actually underlie what we lump together. Take breast cancer, for example, where I came into the game. Breast cancer, at the clinical level, it was diagnosed by as breast cancer, by the cellular characteristic. But to get to that stage requires multiple pathways of genes interacting in a sequence in relationship to each other. When we do genetic studies, we end up being able to find out, yes, we can find a gene that is altered that we can associate with this disease we call breast cancer. But we were not sensitive to the fact that while the science was good for the results you got, we didn't have a full appreciation for what was also important that was not factored into the results we got, which is that the same disease can be caused by another step or another gene in the pathway. So you can't rush to cure breast cancer based on the success you got with a well-designed and carried out study. We can make a product and we can go and treat every woman.
It's not that simple. I see what you mean. I mean, other genes can turn this on. Environmental conditions I would also imagine age could have an impact on this, just the age of the biological entity, the human being.
See, there are some genes that are turned on at different points in time, and we don't necessarily know how that gene is related to the one that we identify.
Yes.
Age is a factor because different genes have different expressions at different stages in the life cycle. The data showed us that Black women, for example, had an early form of breast cancer that was more aggressive. The data were clear. You look at a group of Black women with breast cancer, you look at a comparison group of white women with breast cancer, and the data were clear that Black women had diagnosable clinical breast cancer, but it occurred earlier in life than the stage of occurrence in white. And that's also pointing to there's a different genetics operating in this same clinical problem because they are receptors for different chemicals, which means then when you develop a chemical that will work, in this case, hormone treatment with white women who had a form that had a marker that you can use estrogen to interfere with the bio. But if you're dealing with Black women with a cancer that don't have this marker, you can treat them all day long with a marker that you have good data to show that it was effective for this clinical disorder. And all you're doing is causing a double problem in the Black women in this case, because one, you are not getting at what's the basis of their problem, and you're giving them something foreign that they now have to deal with in terms of the body's mechanism to deal with all kinds of treatments, particularly pharmaceutical treatments.
Funding, I mean, how can I put this? Inequality is always evident in where we dedicate our funds. So research funding that has a preferential option, let's say to white women, that isn't mindful of Black women who are experiencing cancer at a certain age, that's where, just by way of example, we see deep structural inequalities. That happens.
Okay. It wasn't intended to be unequal. This is what, but we must recognize that the very way we do science leads to the inequalities that we are now experiencing as we try to apply the science. In America particularly, being very race conscious in its construct, it also was rampant in even the science. What science we choose to do, who's doing the science. We look at particular the beginning of the Genome Project when I came into it, the usual folk who actually are the thought leaders for what science will be done and who's doing it.
People are hungry, I find, for listening to scientists in their humanity talk about the joy of what they're doing. I mean, we finished, from what you said, the human genome was sequenced in 2003, 2 years ahead of schedule. Mm-hmm. 10 years later, 2013, the Brain Initiative begins.
Was announced. The Brain Initiative, this was under Obama's administration. The Brain Initiative, also an international effort. The goal here now is to map and sequence all the neurons or the brain cells.
Okay.
Knowing that
no
the brain
thing.
Is the organ of expression, if you will, of the mind.
Uh-huh.
And it's now bringing control and regulation. We recognize that the brain controls and regulates the body organ cells and systems, okay? The question becomes, what regulates the brain? And so this brings the question of the role of the mind, okay, into the dialogue of the operating.
And what are we discovering in that inspires you? Because now we've moved from genetics to the regulation of the brain and the question of its interface with the mind. What do you find?
Well, the fact that we have always dealt with the mind, but as a separate entity, you know, we love to partition things. Science almost requires us to partition things in order to study that thing.
Right.
But we sometimes get lost, as you say, in the forest, because we studied this and we begin to make what we studied the whole.
Religion sometimes does this too, you know, where we cordon off into certain doctrines, for instance, without thinking of the whole. I mean, there's a way in which science and religion can learn from each other.
Absolutely.
In this way.
That is the goal. We're looking at this genome, and one of the first challenges to both the scientists and the religion who come with different answers, but one that inspires me is, who created the genome with all of this exquisite design, order, function, and making of man?
Let me go to that in a moment, if I may, Georgia. Can we stay with the brain for another couple of minutes? Because that is just fascinating.
It's very important, the mind-body connection. There's been the whole arena of people studying the mind. Thinking is a biological process. We can now actually put probes on the brain and actually follow energy constructs that go with certain ways of thinking. Thoughts are things. They can amplify each other, they can neutralize each other, or they can depress each other.
Yeah.
But your thinking is a biological process. We are speaking to our genome 24/7. About what the reality is that is in, and it follows our instruction, it follows our word, it makes no judgment. Are you really stressed beyond compare? It just takes the reality that we're in and gives us a genomic response that best adapts us to that environment. So we literally do have to think about what we believe is the truth, because we create based on what we believe, not on what we think. And there have been attempts to look at meditators and look at people who have various kinds of abnormal or brain activity. And we can actually begin to map so that we can measure what's the correlation between the chemistry of this area of the brain, which controls this part of the body, so that we can now begin to see what's the relationship between what we think and the instructions that we are literally giving to the body as to how to survive in the environment that we tell it we're in. That's the lesson of the genomicist. The genome is about survival. It shows us how we have survived as humankind over all kinds of environments. And yet each of us is here because we have a successful genome.
You and I and everyone else living right now are at the cusp of the wave of this genome as it now stands on the planet. And we do have, don't we, a moral responsibility about how we invite or exclude pollutants, let's say, that impact that genome. Or we have a moral responsibility about how we characterize one another in ways that honor the integrity of each of us, not divided into these subdivisions of class or race, certainly racism, these kinds of structures that tear apart our shared humanity. Is it the case, do you think, that our moral responsibility is even more compounded by what you've named? We stand on the shoulders of a genomic giant that we also have responsibility to.
I like to think we have the knowledge of the creator.
Okay.
The creator of the genome, who knows how it was put together, who knows how it works, has now given us, through science, given us the blueprint, if you will, is what the genome was referred to, has given us the manufacturer's handbook, if you will. It's a time where each of us, individually and all of us collectively, have to deal with that same question. Because, first of all, we all share, as you say, the human genome. We all have more things that's similar than the things that's different that oftentimes we have used to separate us.
You've been listening to Religica. Visit us at www.religica.org.